stayed there until 1975, and he died in his bed. Same with Portuguese fascist dictator Salazar. Hitler was not voted out of power either. When he was faced with military defeat from the Russian army to his east and the American and Allied forces to his west, he committed suicide in his bunker. Italy's Mussolini was overwhelmed by Allied forces after 21 years in power. He was killed and hung upside down by his heels in a gas station. So the answer is no. Once a fascist leader gets into power, we have no hope of voting him out.
Why do you think the American labor movement is the most promising countervailing force to a complete fascist takeover in America? Do you see some hopeful signs in that movement?
Well, going back to my earlier comments about the nature of capitalism, fascism has only emerged so far in capitalist states. And one of the reasons is because fascists understand how to use capitalism as a system to concentrate power. As a socialist, I think that the labor, those of us who work with our hands and who we are actually creating the wealth ourselves that capitalism accumulates, which can lead to fascism. So the first step towards stepping away from fascism is to stop creating wealth for those who might become our overlords. Historically, the labor movement has lived on the premise that we are meant to keep as much of that which we create as we can. And I think we see some awareness in the American labor movement right now that this oligarchical system has ruthlessly extracted not just so much of our wealth that belongs to us, but so much democratic potential, which is now slipping away from us. I think that the No Kings March, for example, and also the recent Labor Day marches, which were done in conjunction with a movement called May Day Strong, which started last May, which was really a coalition of labor unions, trade unions, trying to use the streets to express their opposition to this oligarchy. I think it's called Workers versus Billionaires is the slogan. That's really, really important. It makes the connection between wealth inequality and power inequality, which are the ingredients of fascism. And it also shows us that working people are recognizing the value of not only their labor, but their political voice. And this is critical. To go back to what I said earlier about Trotsky felt, you know, that the only way to actually stand up to fascism was for the working class to take power into its own hands, to absolutely stop the upward movement of power and wealth if we had any chance for democracy. I'm optimistic right now, particularly in the last 6 months, that the American labor movement is stepping forward. And I will say, as a member of the American Association of University Professors, our president, Todd Wolfson, has been very open about referring to Trump as a fascist and referring to the attacks on universities, the extraction of money from them, or the extortion, I would say, the attempt to control curriculum, hiring, admissions. That, you know, fascism has always turned to control of universities as a key first step in its playbook. It's been true even in recent years in countries like Hungary, for example, and Israel would be another example where the state's control of universities is all very, very critical to preservation of autocracy. So I think that my union has understood the university as a site of class struggle and as a site where the stakes of fascism are being played out and are really, really high. This kind of consciousness has to persist in the labor movement going forward, I think, if we have any chance of reversing the potential of fascism in this country.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, a co-host, along with Heidi Boghossian. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with our own co-hosts, Michael Smith and Jim Lafferty, who have edited and contributed an introduction to the new book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, published by OR Books. And we're joined by one of those authors, Bill Mullen.
I think it would be helpful for our listeners to understand the contents of our book. And what I want to do is read the title of the chapters and their authors for them. First chapter is The Rise of Christian Fascism by Chris Hedges. Then we have When Capitalism Morphs into Fascism by Richard Wolff. Then we have Unions Must Lead the Fight by Diane Feeley, followed by Militarized Education and the Assault on Free Speech by Henry Giroux. Then we have our guest today, The Law Won't Save Us, Bill Mullen's chapter. We have two concluding chapters, one by Margaret Kimberly, The Duopoly and Liberalism Led to Trump II, and last was the important contribution by Kwame Sawant called A Fighting Strategy for Community-Based Action. That's the content of our book.
Jim, Chris Hedges has said that, quote, it's all over. They've won. He said this, however, before Zohran Mamdani's victory in the New York City mayoral primary. Do you think that victory is a sign of hope? And what about Kashama Sawant's victories running for the City Council of Seattle?
Both of those are indeed hopeful signs of what can be done and what has been done. But let me start by simply saying, no, I do not think it is all over by any means. I don't think the authoritarians have won the victory permanently in any sense. I do think they are now winning. And if the resistance to Trump's fascist behavior and actions dissipates or collapses, then it can be said or will be said then that it'll be all over, at least for the foreseeable future. But things change. Things change. There are any number of examples in this country's history of how hateful repressive actions being overcome. Slavery itself, the period of McCarthyism, the old Jim Crow South, the persecution of the LGBTQ plus community, the repression of women, the war in Vietnam, for heaven's sakes. But achieving freedom and justice is indeed a constant struggle. And it can fairly be said that the current crisis is certainly, the gravest we've faced perhaps as a nation in many a time. And it can also be said that there, though, is already 8 months, only 8 months into Trump's second term, tremendous resistance to what he and his cronies are doing. Millions of people, literally millions of people have been in the streets and over again protesting what he is doing and has done. Even the militarized immigration actions are met with bold and often effective resistance. Already, as has been mentioned, a number of union leaders have supported the idea of a call for a general strike. Now you mentioned Mamdani's surprise victory in New York and the repetitive victories of Kashama Sawant for city council in Seattle. These, again, as I say, are tremendously hopeful signs. The mayoral campaign of Mamdani is a sign that people are starting to realize, very simply, that their best interests lie with supporting anti-capitalist, openly anti-capitalist candidates for office. Polls show, for example, that younger Americans are more supportive of a socialist economic system for America than the current capitalist one. And more voters are choosing to be independent rather than Democratic or Republican Party voters. The history of free speech and the right to protest and the massive exercise of both are part of the political mindset of the American people. And at least so far, the American people have demonstrated their refusal to give up those rights in the face, I should say, of Trump's dictatorial and repressive dictates. So it's not all over at all. In fact, as I say, the resistance is demonstrating itself to be strong, very much alive, and very much willing to continue to take on the battle against the fascist Donald Trump.
Bill, part of that resistance is coming in the courts. I believe over 400 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration. Over 200 injunctions have been granted. But I've said elsewhere, and you in your book say that you can't count on the courts. They may be necessary, but not sufficient. Share your thoughts on that, please.
Sure. Well, I'll start with something Michael said earlier, which is I think that the only way we really get rid of a dictator or a Trumpian figure is through mass means. We're not going to legislate him away. We're not going to elect him away, I don't think. And that's really been historically true. It means that there are limits to what the law can do to help us in a situation like this. And it's, as I talk about in my book, it's also true that very often the law can be our enemy in a situation like this. And that's the moment we live in. And Jim was talking about the Enabling Act of 1933 that kind of turned Hitler loose to do what Franco called prerogative law. Trump's control of the Supreme Court and arrangement of the Supreme Court is kind of an enabling law. And what I mean by that is that's meant to be the final check on his power. So far, it's done almost nothing but extend his power and affirm this theory of the executive branch is holding absolute power. Most American, I raised the example that that Jim cited of the influence of Jim Crow law and race law in the United States on the Third Reich. The history of race law in this country is coming back to haunt us right now. Trump is using that 14th Amendment, that attempt to overturn birthright citizenship, to appeal to his white supremacist base that wants to see anyone who's born in the United States to an immigrant not be able to have citizenship. The root of this is race law. This, the 14th Amendment was put into place because black people and slaves could not be citizens because of slavery up until the passing of the 14th Amendment. So there's a boomerang, right, effect of the law coming back right now against, Trump is using it against ourselves and our attempt to hold democracy. The other thing I would say about the law, and this is a kind of a Marxist perspective, most what we call rule of law is meant to protect private property. If you open up any, you know, penal code in the United States, the vast majority of laws are going to be about things like stealing money and fraud and counterfeit and petty theft and pickpocketing. It's really the law as it's developed in capitalist states is 9 times out of 10 meant to guarantee that the system of capitalism is protected at all costs. I would argue right now that the legal system is kind of in a polarized mode where it is much of the legal system is actually doing the work of protecting Trump, because historically, as a capitalist leader, he has merited that kind of protection, also being president of the United States. There is a countervailing force, obviously, which is in the complex legal arrangement of the United States, which has federal, state, local law. We are seeing that tension play out. It's not clear which way it's going to fall. And I wouldn't also say, to larger discussion, I wouldn't say necessarily that the law is playing no role. I mean, every revolutionary knows. Angela Davis said, some days you have to call for burning down the courthouse. Some days you have to go to court to defend yourself. Right? We are stuck with a system which we have to use to try to adjudicate our freedom. And I believe at the end of the day, what I would argue we need to do is create a society which is actually based on an understanding of social justice, which is not about protecting private property, but which is about putting everyone in our society on an equal footing.
Michael, on Monday, August 26, Trump signed an executive order creating a mobile force of 600 people to crack down on protesting in virtually any American city. The week prior, he offered a $50,000 signing bonus and forgiveness of student loans for young people who sign up with ICE. What is your reaction to this?
This is a giant step in the wrong direction. They tried to do something like this in 2006 when it was proposed that the National Guard from one state could be used by the president and sent to another state without the express consent of either governor of either state. They couldn't get away with it. So now the Trump people figured out a way to get around it. to use the National Guard in Washington, D.C., which is governed directly by the federal government and not by a mayor. Trump sent troops to Washington. Now there are troops in Washington from South Carolina and Mississippi, and they can send them anywhere to other cities across the country. So Trump is now threatening Baltimore and Chicago. And I'd like to hear the reaction of some of our guests on what it means that he's doing this and what people can do about it.
Jim, Trump has subdued institutions that might stand in his way. We just heard comments regarding the Supreme Court. We know that major law firms have capitulated. Universities like Columbia have, in large measure. Public broadcasting is being demolished, and major media are largely falling in line. Looking at that whole set of institutions, how do you evaluate that?
Well, it's very sad, but it's not at all surprising. I don't think it's surprising at all that in a, you know, bottom line capitalist society economy like ours, that our institutions who want federal support, including colleges and universities who depend a lot on federal support, that they would agree to unreasonable demands from Trump to keep their federal dollars flowing is, I suppose, sad, certainly, but not terribly surprising. Or in the case of some of the nation's biggest law firms, they have caved in many cases so that they can still have access to federal courts, even though it means agreeing to do millions of dollars of free legal work for Trump. It's shameful, of course. And indeed, those colleges that have stood and fought, and those big law firms that fought and didn't cave, have been winning their victories. So it shows there wasn't a need to do that when you fight back. What, of course, should have been the response of all of them is what some of them have said. They've said no, they went to court, they're winning the battles in court. What Trump really has tried to do, of course, is what a dictator would do. And that's crippled those institutions that are likely to be challenging his ideas. Institutions like colleges and universities that champion free thought, that weaken attorneys' will to present those and represent those who challenge the dictator's power. That's something you don't do under a fascist country. But the big law firms in this country that stood their ground are still able to do just that. It's really not surprising, I suppose, that Trump has done what he has done. He is a would-be king or dictator like those who drafted the infamous, as I mentioned before, Project 25 document, want to weaken any and all institutions that pose any material or intellectual threat to his rule, to his regime. In the case of what he's been doing with colleges and universities, he used the excuse that our nation's top institutions of higher learning were what? Hotbeds of anti-Semitism because of their campus protests against what Israel is doing in Palestine. Well, that's just nonsense, of course. The demonstrations were generally organized by or in conjunction with the group Jewish Voice for Peace, hardly an anti-Semitic group. Demonstrations have been largely peaceful on these campuses. But such demonstrations were nevertheless, of course, in opposition to Trump's and the United States' military, financial, and political support for Israel. Really, quite simply, I think Trump has and is prepared to continue when he can, taking dictatorial action against any and all U.S. institutions that don't simply march to his tune. What is it now? He's up to, I think, nearly $500 billion in congressionally appropriated funds that he's held up and hasn't allowed to be used as Congress intended. And also, you mentioned, I think, public radio. Certainly, that's very much in our mind here at Law and Disorder. Look what he's done said Congress do in respect to public radio in America. The drastic cut in financial support for our nation's public radio stations is truly shameful. His crippling effect on smaller and rural community public radio stations is going to be profound. It's simply a lie that public radio is a bastion, you know, of liberal broadcasting. And anybody who listens to it, as I do and as so many, many millions of Americans do, know that's the case. Public radio stations, for heaven's sakes, go out of their way to present balanced programming and news reporting. The effect of this cutback and this federal money, especially in rural areas, is going to be to deprive residents in some cases, of the only reliable information they get on coming tornadoes or on such matters in the news as to the well-being, it affects the well-being of those living in those areas. Well, our own show, this show, now airs on what is it, close to 200 stations, I'm proud to say, mainly public radio stations in America. Many of them are in rural America. Well, the real reason that the Congress voted, of course, to slash public radio funding is because the reactionary Congress and Trump don't want all sides. It's not that it's one liberal side that's being presented. They don't want that side. They don't want all sides being reported. They'd rather leave journalism in America to the corporate media, which is hardly presenting both sides fairly. They don't want free journalism practice in America. And the sad fact is this: no democracy can long survive where there is no free press reporting the facts and the news to the people of that democracy. So until public radio is fully funded again here in these United States, all who care about democracy and a free press should dig a little deeper. We're going to have to dig a little deeper in our pockets when the local public radio station is having a fund drive. And we thank those who listen to our show and urge them to continue to support their local public station wherever they may be listening.
Bill, Jim, and Michael, this has been a wonderful hour. We thank you so much for publishing your fine book, From the Flag to the Cross. Now, how can people get a hold of it? Jim mentioned the OR site. Are there other venues you recommend?
Get it directly from the publisher. If you get it from Amazon, the publisher makes about 10%. Amazon, as we all know, is a ripoff. OrBooks.com, get it from OrBooks. I want to remind people that Paul Buell said in his first review of our book, it's an eminently useful book. I hope it will be widely read. OrBooks.com.
I echo, of course, what Michael has said. It's a very readable book. It's not a terribly long book. It's something that one will learn a great deal about, not only the history of fascism, but come to understand why that is developing in this country, but can yet be stopped. It's a book that provides both the history of it and the way in which we defeat the coming fascism in America. So From the Flag to the Cross should be on everybody's reading list, and it can be purchased for a very low price at orbooks.com.
I'll just add my thanks to Mike and Jim for putting the book together and including me in it. For me, the book is a wonderful toolkit to fight this current creeping fascism. And it's also a great reminder that how powerful ideas are and that we have to protect ideas and thought if we have a chance of actually materially changing the course of the history that we're trying to change right now.
You're right, Bill. This book is a how to do it course in how to fight the coming fascism so that we can indeed defeat it.
Well, once again, thank you, Bill, Jim, and Michael, for this important book and for joining us on Law and Disorder. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member, but interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events, but when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, etc. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted Black Lives Matter, and then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired, even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections, right, that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union, but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats, right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted, and in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 a.m. when people are expecting to be sleeping, right? So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, et cetera, we need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, you know, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird, it's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah, so I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right, there's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained, right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage a class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them, right, in a disrespectful or harmful way. You know, I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but, you know, put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned. And then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. You know, so that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah, and also, I think a thing about professors is that most of them, by far, are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance and the students have to know or have to at least feel that they're at risk of, if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups, does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world, racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression, and we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. The fence was posting messages that were very, very, provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian Alliance students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive and what the Jewish students were hearing and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who's going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens, with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate and some of the people coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event, from people who came and were on counter-protest to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe and that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest. Has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register versus you're a group that's conservative register, we don't care. The only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So, as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Shinas about free speech. So, on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chorminsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved, and one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff, if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic or, you know, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky you know, issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on. And so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing. You might think that I'm a okay person, and I'm okay, well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make a judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, for, you know, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us, it's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grinnell, Ambassador Grinnell, coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right, which was also, I think, highly controversial, but we stood up and we protected her ability to say that and Rick O'Neill's ability to say that and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cohen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in. Get it out there and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, We were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be, we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is, suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany, and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said, no, don't say anything. And the same thing, I think, about George Floyd. I mean, I think that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society, that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak, and then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. You'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say, I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think, so we have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities. Right. Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right, you know, inevitably and the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, or and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations and we consider, well, we need to respond to that, they're saying something we know to be false, somebody else says, don't say anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things, troll people, and use statements that they would never say face-to-face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think that, so I think it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day, made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well, I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme. But I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were, like, interacting with their friends. Sometimes they'd speak in person. Sometimes they'd call them on the phone. Sometimes they'd text them. And they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be, right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how you're going to say something. But the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully, over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of, it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly. But if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap, right? And I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if that's your main diet and you get addicted to it, it's just stressful, you feel anxious, you don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into contexts in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech, right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
she's a housewife. And her husband's with the night shift at the plant for 30 years. They got a nice little trailer in a nice little corner. And a poodle they love like a child they never had. They go to the VFW club on Friday night. She gets a sludge in the fence and some fries from the kitchen. Tip the waitress 50 cents. Has her hair done the same way that she has for 30 years. Some say life's useless, it's born, it's dull. But she's happy, she's satisfied, and nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Ellis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't have. Cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy. She has a hobby. She paints ceramics and bowls twice a month. She goes dancing with her husband when I can. The wrestling matches at the local arena. Some say life's useless, it's fun, it's dull. But she's happy, she's satisfied. And nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Elvis died. She doesn't color what she doesn't have. Cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy. Life's useless, it's fun, it's dull. But she's happy, she's satisfied. And nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Elvis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't have. Cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy. And nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day. Doesn't cover what she doesn't have. Cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Original girl, you want a replica?
No.
Smoothie, no regular, regular.
No.
Pretty for real, I'm pretty for my cellular.
No.
You don't say you had.
No.
They never.